Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Fill her up!
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ralph Sutton, the SDR Show. This week, we have Headbangers Ball legend Ricky Rackman comes on the show, and we get into various debates on music. If you're a fan of Ricky Rackman, you could have heard this 5 days ago at gasdigital.com. Use the code SDR14, get a 14-day free trial, or use the code SDR, get a 7-day free trial. Whichever one you want to do, I'll let you do either one. But here it is right now, the Ricky Rackman episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone watch the host. It's weed, I beat, it's hookers and blow. It's art, it's fart, you need to know. The SDR Show. Let's go.
It is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. I am Ralph Sutton, back with me once again from his kitchen. I've never asked you this, James. Can you cook?
I'm very good. I used to, when I had roommates, was called the king of culinary the minister of snacks, but I don't have a pot and pan here.
Did you say the minister of snatch?
Minister of snacks, so for like Super Bowl parties and that. Okay. That too, at certain points, not right now. I had an ex who was going to get me pots and pans, but now she's an ex, so that shit ain't coming, baby.
Okay, yeah. You know, I went to culinary school and ran a restaurant for 4 years, so maybe we can have a cook-off at one point. We'll see what happens.
You'll destroy me. I see what you post every day, like sushi, bacon, waffles. You're the king of fusion, baby.
All right, I'm going to introduce this guy the way he deserves to be introduced, because there's few people that I feel are true rock and roll icons such as this man. Television radio personality, owner of the Cat House, creator of the Cat House, former host of the Headbangers Ball. Currently, I think a brief break on it, but going back out again on his One Foot in the Gutter tour, been involved with the WWE, with NASCAR, was at once quoted as the king of L.A. sleaze.
The good moniker.
And recently, some dude paid for him and the entire restaurant free meal, and he decided to pay it forward. Few people that I think of when I think of true rock and roll, it is fucking Ricky Rackman. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. I mean, now I'm really good with that intro. Thank you. I'll just be completely honest with you. I know I've done some cool stuff and there's some stuff I'm very proud of, but I'm just like a guy, you know, I'm just like a guy. So when I hear those type of introductions, and I love them, I'm not going to lie, but it still seems like they're talking about me, like, you know, I work hard every single day. But it's weird, and you look back at some of the things, and it's surreal. But I'm so grateful, and it's bizarre because.
Let me ask you this. So here's what's funny is that I was like the poor man's Ricky Rackman in a way, and I'll explain what I mean by that. I ran rock clubs in New York around the time, maybe a little after you were doing the Cat House, and we'll get into other stuff too. But I was involved with the Limelight and L'Amour, which was like the East Coast version of the Cat House at the time. I don't know which one was doing rock first. It was about the same time, roughly, I think.
I think first of all, I was in a band called Battery Club that played both of those shows, which was interesting because L'Amour's was probably our worst show ever. And Limelight was one of our best shows ever. But those clubs are both pretty much live venues. I know I've been to both of them, and I like both of them a real lot. But Cat House was never intended to be a live venue. You know,
Limelight had the back room that people would go to just be a part of that. Yeah. So, and I also like back in the day, you would always. We're going to talk a lot about the bands that I grew up in loving, stuff like that. But you know, when you watched a band, and when Guns N' Roses would wear a Cat House shirt, I was like, oh shit, what's that? And I remember distinctly when Slash wore a Limelight shirt. I was like, oh shit, he's wearing a Limelight shirt. So those kind of things were so important back then It was a wild time, but I want to start with, before we get to the Get Out, you, at one point you said in an interview, you never lived more than 6 miles from the Strip. But then you also said you lived in New Zealand for a year and a half at 16. So right. Once you left New Zealand is when you moved to California, or did that come about?
I grew up in Los Angeles. I actually was born in New York City, but went to LA like probably I was 2 years old. And I lived in Hollywood. I lived in Los Angeles. For a time, I lived in Van Nuys, which was about 6-7 miles from the Strip, and then moved back to Hollywood. And when I was 15, I was not a great kid. And my father was in New Zealand, and they couldn't handle me. So they sent me to New Zealand to go live with my dad, and I couldn't handle it there. So then they sent me back, and then I came back, and that was when I was about 15 and a half, 16. So I did spend a year living in New Zealand, when I was like 15 and a half.
Okay, and then you came back to Cali, and now you don't live, you live with your wife, I forget where, but not in California anymore.
No, I'm in North Carolina now.
Okay, that's fun. Probably. That's nice. So here's what's interesting. First, I want you to settle an argument with me, because your roommate in L.A. was Tame Me Down a Faster Pussycat, right?
Yeah.
I've always heard this, and I don't know if it's true, but that he wanted people to pronounce it Tie Me Down, as in the S&M thing, but people said Tamey, so he just went with it. Just like with Janie Lane of Warrant, his name's Johnny, so he wrote it that way, thought he was being creative. People called him Janie, he just went with it. Is that true, or you don't know if that's true?
I knew the day that I met Tamey, there was a mud wrestler, now this is a long time ago, and gave me a card of this cool guy she met, and they said, Tie Me Down. No, it said, this is what it said. It said, Tame Me Down if you can. So in a picture of like Marilyn Monroe, I think. So I thought it was like, Tie Me Down if you can. And then I went to a party that nobody was really at, but Tamey was there. And this is before Faster Pussycat. And we just happened to meet. And I think it was started eventually, initially as Tie Me Down. I think it was. You know, it's kind of a weird thing. And I'll just tell you this. For people that I grew up with, that were important parts of my life, like Tamey and Gilby and guys in Guns N' Roses, there's a lot of questions that are like rock questions you would ask them that I never asked.
Right.
Because these are just like my friends, and you wouldn't ask those things of your friends, you know?
Right.
So that's a good question. And I bet, and this is just, I'm guessing that he did try to be, that it was eventually set up as Tie Me Down, because I remember this business card said, Tie Me Down, and if you can.
Yeah, which only makes sense if you pronounce it as Tie Me Down. It doesn't make sense if it's Tame Me Down.
I'm going to say that to a girl tonight after her show. I'm going to be like, Tame Me Down, if you can, baby.
If you can.
Yeah, that works really good these days.
You're in the the epicenter of rock and roll in L.A. in the mid-'80s, and the story basically goes that you're looking for a place to meet strippers and get free drinks, and that was the birth of the Cat House, correct?
Absolutely. I mean,
and that is 86?
Well, the idea came up in like 85, and then it was 86. It was September when we opened up the club. And, you know, I had been a club DJ, and I had DJed some clubs, and, you know, it was interesting. A picture of Tommy Lee's wedding and Heather Locklear just popped up in my feed today. I was a DJ at that wedding.
That's crazy.
Amazing.
That was 85, and that was the first time as a DJ I started playing rock and roll. So even though I was a rocker, I was still playing like dance music. But then I was like, what if we just opened up a club? Because all my friends were like starting bands.
Right.
Like, what if we just opened up this like dance club that our friends could hang out? Because I was that guy that would show up to the cool clubs and the Velvet Rope was there, and I would never get in. And I get so, because I was never a cool guy. Still aren't. But I would never get to let it in. So I was like, fuck these people. I'm going to open up my own club that doesn't have a Velvet Rope, where all of us misfits can sit. I mean, the one thing that I think people don't understand is the Sunset Strip scene and the Cat House Hollywood scene were really very, very different. It's like, you know, it was, even though a lot of the people from that scene hung out at Cat House and we would still go up to the Sunset Strip, our scene was very dark, dirty, more punky than maybe the Sunset Strip, even though we did have big hair and we'd had makeup, but it wasn't like striped spandex or anything like that. It looked like we were sleeping in the gutter, because a lot of us were.
Right. Well, the question would be, though, at that age, I'm guessing if you, it was 85, you're probably 17, 20, something like that, in that area, roughly. I don't know exactly.
I'm old as dirt. I'm so old.
Well, I'm 54. I think you're 58, so you're four years older than me.
Wikipedia lied and has lied forever, and I just didn't bother correcting anybody. So whenever anybody would say, like, oh, how old are you? I'm like, how old do you think I am? And they always guess wrong, so I always agree with them. I'm 61.
Oh, okay. Wow, well, relatively close. You look great. But so
you look unbelievable, like,
so we'll say
Ricky.
You're 20-something.
I've had no work done, nothing done.
Look at this.
How did you get the money to get the club open at that age?
It took no money, because the one thing that I can tell you, I mean, currently I'm not saying this like, ooh, look at me. It's like, I own an apparel company. I own a small coffee company. I do all these things. My whole life has not been agents, managers, publicists. I go out and I do that stuff myself. And I don't want to sound like, ooh, but if you truly believe in yourself, you can convince people that you know what you're doing,
right,
when you don't. So I found a club that was really popular in the disco era that was really run down. And I walk in this club, I go, look, I'm going to have this rock and roll dance club, and you guys make the bar and I'll make the door. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have money, and Tammy had less than me. So basically the investment was getting flyers. That was investment. And it started so grassroots, but, like, you know, the first people there, Guns N' Roses and, you know, Faster, of course. And then it, like, Steven Tyler was showing up, and Billy Gibbons, because they heard that this is this, like, dark, dangerous club that had, and when I say this, I don't say this as a cliche, it's just a fact. The most beautiful women in the world went to Cat House, because it wasn't a club that they would go to where every guy would be picking up on them, you know?
Right.
It was a club that you could just do whatever you wanted. I mean, we really didn't care.
And no cameras were allowed. That was part of it. But there's crazy stories. Like, I've heard that, you know, Christina Applegate was a co-check girl for a bit. And there's stories of Brad Pitt waiting online to try and get in. And it just crazy stuff. And then the famous one that I think a lot of people have heard about, Axel and David Bowie. And Bowie, Bowie chasing Axel because, or Axel chasing Bowie because Bowie hit on Axel's girlfriend.
Yes.
Spectacular.
Crazy shit like that. And we're not talking about, like, in 1984. We're talking about when they are who they are. You know what I mean?
At this point, Guns N' Roses. I mean, the thing that I'm so lucky is that Guns N' Roses, I don't think I'd be sitting here talking if it wasn't for them. But when they didn't have a record deal, we were all hanging out. But then as Guns N' Roses got bigger and bigger and bigger, they still stayed true and knew that they could go to the Cat House and nobody would screw with them.
Right.
To the point that they're the biggest rock and roll band in the world. They're playing with the Rolling Stones, and they call me and say, hey, can we shoot a video there? So the It's So Easy video was shot at the Cat House when they were still, like, the biggest band around.
Which is great. And also, like, another one of these big, like, for long time feuds was the Axl Vince Neil feud. You did a Cat House podcast about it last year. And people don't know that they were friends at one point. Like, Molly brought Guns N' Roses out on tour at one point. And now I'm sure that they still hate each other to this day, I imagine, which is just childish. We're all adults. Let it go. But it is what it is.
I have a recording. It's not a good recording, but of Axel and Vince singing Whole Lotta Rosie at the Cat House. And of course, my rule was, because you got to understand, when people say, oh, you guys lived in the most craziest time, it was so amazing. But it was just how we were living. We didn't understand. Like, I never thought that I would still be selling Cat House, or the name would still be such a great brand, or that people would be talking about it, because we really just opened it up to get free drinks and meet girls and have a safe place. That was the only reason it was opened up. So I said, with no cameras in there, people will feel like they can do whatever they want. And they did, because I wanted people to feel comfortable. I wanted people to know that they could do whatever they want there without repercussions. I mean, we lived at a time that there weren't cell phones back then. Mm-hmm. But I was still very strict. And I was like, look, you can't bring your camera in here, because if this guy's making out with this girl over there, and if this band gets to, you know, like, you know, Vince and Axel getting up on stage playing, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I just didn't want anybody to ever I kind of regret some of it, not having cameras. I would have loved to have some of it on video, but I don't.
All right, before we go any further, I can personally tell you I recently used this product, and it helped me tremendously get on an early flight the next day. I'm talking about Capsulite, spelled Capsulyte. If you're planning a real drinking day like we did recently on Shannon's The Thing Is episode, me and Big J did a bonus episode of a power hour. I did Capsulite before, during, and after, and felt fucking much better. I was able to get on a flight the next day without vomiting. It's doctor formulated. It supports your liver. And if you take it before and during drinking, you will wake up the next day not feeling like shit. And I'm going to give you a code that gets you 30% off. The promo code is GAS. And you go to Capsulite.com, Capsulyte.com. Use the code GAS. Save 30% and don't feel like shit the next day. What more could you ask for? Let's get back into it. So then what's crazy is I don't know what the year run, if it's 85, 86, it opened. It lasted till when, the original Cat House?
I think it was probably 86 to about 92 or 3.
Right, because that's when everything, because I was a DJ at Limelight and Lemoore and stuff. 92 was that year that everything like went to shit once, you know, it became not cool anymore to be in like a hair band or a rock band. Everybody wanted to follow the grunge era, and a lot of the rock clubs in New York closed down. That's what happened.
I mean, the whole grunge thing, I've never agreed with all of those things that this killed this. I mean, no, it didn't kill it. It was people stopped going out. I don't want to get all heated up about it. But,
get heated, Ricky. This is what we want.
Let's talk about it. Because there was one year.
Sick.
Sorry. Let me say this. There was one year. I think it was 91, 92, where I was a DJ. You could play everything. You could play Alice in Chains, Nirvana, Guns N' Roses, AC/DC. Last Action Hero was a great example of that, where it's all AC/DC, Tesla, and Alice in Chains are on that record. But then it became, at one point, just like goofy or not cool for whatever reason to be in a hair band. It is what it is.
But whose fault is that?
I would blame MTV.
Oh my God. That's the stupidest thing in the world. And I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
If you have a band and all of a sudden that band is not popular, that band is not popular because people aren't going to the shows. If anything killed, first of all, metal is not dead. I go to shows all the time. I love going to shows. Metal is 100% not dead. But if you're talking about a scene that's dead, the only reason any scene would be dead is because its fans stop supporting it. Hey, thrash bands have been thriving. They've never stopped thriving. Exodus is out playing, you know, and they're still probably bigger than they were.
Well, I mean, I'm going to play devil's advocate to that, which is that a large amount of people follow trends. They don't necessarily.
Absolutely.
So they don't necessarily go with they're not audiophiles. They hear hot girls like Def Leppard, so they go to a Def Leppard show, right? And once that becomes not mainstream, they look for the next mainstream thing because they're followers of a trend as opposed to diehard fans of a genre. Does that make any sense?
Okay. You're going to a rock and roll show. Do you want to see a bunch of people that are following the trend, or do you want to go to a rock and show that's not as crowded,
but
has true rock and roll fans?
But I'm saying I think that's what killed that style of music. It became still almost like, so like that, you know, Absolutely. Look, I love this music. It's one of my favorite stuff in the world, but the day that Nirvana premiered on Dial MTV, Tough was the number one song on Dial MTV. I forgot the name of their hit that they had. I forgot the name of the song. And I had a radio show for 18 years that was dedicated to all this music. I loved it all, but it did. The genre just changed. And it's like there are people that at one point I'm sure thought big band music is never going to die. Like where, you know, Count Basie Orchestra, they're selling out every week. And then at one point, tastes change. That is what happens.
That's what's great about the case with
everything
is, I mean, there's no scene that stays around. Everything right. changes, because if you do something that's new and fresh and you keep doing the same thing, all of a sudden people are going to be like, oh, I need something new.
Right.
But But, you know, if I love Skid Row and I'm going to go see Skid or Faster Pussycat, I love Faster Pussycat and I'm going to go see Faster Pussycat. And then all of a sudden, Faster Pussycat's got a gold record. And then all of a sudden, people are moving on to whatever's next. Oh, that no, it's the freaking fans that killed it. You know, nothing is right. Dead. I still go to rock shows. And yeah, do I go see shows that maybe these bands aren't playing in front of, you know, 100,000 people? Maybe they're just playing small clubs. I mean, Jackal's playing a small club in North Carolina. I go every single time.
Yeah, I mean, I love him.
He's always going to have a good time.
Yeah, I agree. Look, I agree with you. It's never going to be – every genre goes through this. It's never going to be
– genre.
Yeah, but it lasted – by the way, this genre that we're kind of talking about, focusing on right now, lasted longer than most. You know what I mean? Like, that rap rock trend was only a few years. The a lot of these trends that became – super popular only lasted 5 years, 4 years. The rock scene that we're talking about, we're talking it was well over a decade that it was the genre.
But there's a lot of bands. There's a lot of bands that didn't have the substance. There's a lot of bands that made it because of the look. And that gets real boring. Like, that's why, like, you know, I'm going to save it for a podcast one day about the term hair metal, which I think is I hate that term, because when I had the Cat House, which all of the bigger bands from that genre played, nobody ever said they were playing hair metal. When you say hair metal, what you're saying is a great rock and roll scene that was defined by the big hair, which is a freaking.
Well, what do you just call it rock? But then rock is just such a giant.
You know what we called it back then? Back then, as bands like Guns N' Roses and Faster Pussycat were starting, and Poison for that matter, a lot of them were using the term glam. Even though, and when people say, oh, glam is so and so, fuck no, man. Glam gave us Alice Cooper. Glam gave us Bowie. Glam
E-Rex.
Aerosmith and Slade.
New York Dolls. E-Rex. I agree with you, but
the
I think
Rocks, yeah. New York Dolls. You know, that's glam. And these bands were influenced by them.
Right. Maybe they should have called themselves a new glam or something like that. I don't know.
It was glam metal when I was a kid.
Glam metal.
Glam metal.
The term I hated always was butt rock. I thought butt rock was a dumb term.
But that was all when like grunge and like punkers were coming up and they just wanted to hate on it. Here's the irony. Because of Headbangers Ball, Ricky, it was great. Those 2 hours when I wasn't getting laid in high school and was in more awkward than I am now, you would play Alice in Chains and then there would be a Jackal video. And then there'd be an AC/DC. You'd sneak in Def Leppard when there's a goddamn sword in the video and half-naked girls in a cage, which is 90% of the videos. We were still getting it. And by the time I went into high school, those bands weren't cool. Or by the time I went to college, when I graduated, one of my gifts was Motley Crue's Greatest Hits. And I'm blasting it in my room during the party, and people are losing their mind. It took a few years to come back. But there was one of the reasons was your show kept a little bit of the toes in the water with that shit. And then eventually everyone's like, oh, it's just good rock. Good rock.
I mean,
I would
say there's only two kinds of music, good and bad. But Ricky, you never actually picked a video. They kind of programmed it for you. Did you ever try and really push for like, hey, guys, I love this band. Can we try this band?
Absolutely. I never had any say except on my birthday. I said, can I pick one thing? And the only thing they approved was, of course, my favorite band, Motorhead. That was the only thing they approved. I never had any say in video. And as much as people come up to me, which sucks because, you know, if I could have done my own show, it would have been a lot of different. I do not believe if there was a video that was played in prime time that it should have ever been played on Headbangers Ball.
Right.
Alice in Chains is a rock band. Soundgarden is a rock band. Just as Slayer and Possessed and everything else is a rock band. I mean, the most requested band the entire time I did Headbangers Ball was always Slayer. Slayer was always the, and we should have Slayer at every show. But if we play Slayer and we play, you know, Venom and any of these other bands, should we also play Faster Pussycat? Absolutely. But as soon as one of those, but we should never play a ballad. But as soon as one of those songs becomes a hit, well, you're seeing that during the daytime. You're even seeing Megadeth song during the daytime. So that means a time that maybe we should start playing Wake Up Dead. We shouldn't disregard those and say, oh, they sold out, they're on during primetime. Headbangers Ball should have been the place that you got the music that you didn't get anywhere else.
Agreed.
We shared it with the regular playlist with MTV, that's when I feel we lost it because it's like, hey, I'm going to sit home Saturday night and watch videos that nobody else sees. Wait a minute. I just saw Alice in Chains and I just saw Megadeth on.
And it's okay if it was Alice in Chains and Megadeth, as long as it was deeper tracks or tracks that they weren't playing in the mainstream. But all right, before we go any further, you've heard us talk about this company for years because they've been supporting the show for 4 years. We're talking about YoKratom, YoKratom.com, home of that $60 kilo. The cool way to curate kratom is in $60 kilo form. You get high-quality kratom, unique strains, unique blends, all available exclusively at YoKratom.com, shipped direct to you, super quick, in that cool kilo format. It's YoKratom.com. They've been sponsoring us for years. Support the sponsors that support the show and get that kratom in cool kilo quantities. YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. All right, let's get back into it. So let's talk about this, because this is a wild story. I don't know if everybody knows this, but you got the gig hosting Headbangers Ball with no experience of interviewing or doing anything like that. But Axel flew with you to New York and said, get this guy on the air. And that's how it started. You replaced Adam Curry, who went on to become the godfather of podcasting, which is wild, but that's how that whole started, right? Is that, did they fire him first, or like, how did that come about?
What happened was, and yes, that is basically how it happened, but, and I'm going to, when I get post all these podcast stuff, it's going to go deeper into that. But what happened was when I did the audition, and I was horrible and for the first year of the show as well. But when I went to MTV and then they said, hey, we're going to have you be like the man in the streets. So Adam would toss to me and I had a free location because I opened up another club called Bordello. Right. So, oh, and here's Ricky Rackman at Bordello with Steve Jones or Junkyard or Faster Pussycat or something like that.
By the way, side note, wasn't there a time when and Bordello, Cher and Michelle Pfeiffer were in the DJ booth with you?
Yes.
That's
no,
crazy.
Not with me. Cher and Michelle Pfeiffer were in the DJ booth with our DJ Joseph, who was friends with this designer, this Michael Schnapp, this big design. No, not Mike Schnapp.
Schnapp was an A&R guy.
I know. It was, believe me, nobody's ever confused him of being a fashion guy. I forgot what the guy's name, great guy, but a lot of celebrities would show up at Bordello because nobody ever bugged him. And Cher and Michelle Pfeiffer were in the DJ booth. And, you know, God, that must have been incredible. It just was what I lived in. It was incredible, but I didn't really understand or get a grasp because remember, I've never done anything with the intention first of making money. I've always done things that I thought were going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, I still, you know, any projects that I get involved in is this going to be something that I like to do?
So they were cutting to you as the man on the street. And then at some point they said, all right, we're going to get rid of Adam and bring you in. Is that what happened?
Pretty much. They said they're going to start night. It was 89. And they said, we're going to bring you in. I'm like, okay. And I went in there and they teased my hair up and they put makeup on and they do wardrobe. And I was like, I'm going to be on TV. Like, I'd never been on TV. I'm a freaking street punk. I didn't expect to do any of this stuff. And so I went, I remember that when they went to audition, like some of the guys I used to hang out with were questionable. And we went to New York for the first time and all the guys came with me and we got in a big, huge fight in a club and everybody's like fist fighting, everybody's throwing out. And they're like, who's this guy that we're bringing in here? and my first time on MTV, I was terrible. And, you know, I asked all the questions that were on a card. I did everything that they wanted me to do. And, you know, it was just, I had no TV experience at all. And, you know, I watched some of those Headbangers Balls and I cringe. I'm like, oh my God. And then as I got more and more comfortable and sort of had the whatever, I would do stupid shit. I mean, whether it's cut all my hair off, whether it's weird clothes, whether it's, you know, cause crap with Danzig or Dave Mustaine or do all these things. I did whatever I wanted with the exception of ever saying anything bad about another band. Because if I did that, I'd go, oh, well, if I was on Headbangers Ball, I would have said, screw you to those bands. I'm like, really? Well, here I am making a lot of money going to New York with a job. I did what they told me, but I never said, there's a lot of bands that I said I liked on that show. And that's because I liked them, but I couldn't say the bands that I didn't like.
Right. I got you. So now let me ask you some questions about your time there. So number one, do you remember your first interview? Who it was?
It was, I believe, well, the first video interview on location at Bordello was, I think it was Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols, Junkyard, Faster Pussycat, and maybe LA Guns. And then my first interview in the studio, I believe it was Anthrax and Suicidal Tendencies.
Wow.
And oh my God, I can't watch that Anthrax interview because I'm so, so bad. My hair looks stupid. I look stupid. And I was just horrendous.
So now, okay. So now the other questions are this, is that A, you know, people used to think Dave Mustaine hated you. I know you were good friends, and it was just, he did that so people would talk about it. Just like the Alice in Chains in Action Park is the one I remember more than anything else, especially as a lover of Action Park. But were there any interviews that you did that you didn't air for whatever reason? Because it just was a shit show, or that never, whatever you recorded, they aired?
No, they did air it all.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's fucking cool.
They aired it all. I mean, you know, there was certain times that I was a little bit outspoken in the slightest bit, and it got me into trouble. So, people criticize me sometimes, and they'll say a lot. Well, they criticize me all the time, but people would say something like, oh yeah, well, Ricky would say every band was his favorite band. If you really looked at it, the three favorite bands were Motorhead, Suicidal, and Danzig. Mm-hmm. But when there was a band like the London Choir Boys that I really liked, I'm like, I would give them praise, or Queensryche or stuff like that, because there was a time that I was playing a lot of videos that I didn't really like. But I couldn't say I don't like this. So when there was a band that I really liked, I would be all excited, like, hey, we're going to play this band, which of course everybody thinks is kissing ass, you know?
Right.
I said it to this day. I get it. When Kerry King released that song, I'm like, this song is so insane. Ricky Rackman's kissing his ass. So I'm like, oh my God, you guys are such idiots. And that they are in the minority, but of course they're the ones that like to post stuff, and they're just,
oh, I agree with you. London Choir Boys is a band that deserves more respect because they were so great.
Phenomenal.
Let me ask you this. Would you have like one of my favorites? And it was somewhat awkward, I think, was Nirvana. When you do that and Kurt is drugged out and in that prom dress, like when the cameras stop, do you talk? Like, do you like what's it like after that? It was so weird, and you did a great job with it, and it's crazy because I love them so much, but it's the weirdest fucking thing I ever saw on television.
The whole thing is, you know, what I usually would do is when there was a band on Headbang, and I remember that's when we shot in LA, because I used to ride my motorcycle to the studio all the time. And I remember being excited because Nirvana was on, and when I was a big fan of the record Bleach.
Great record.
So I remember going in there, and I'm like, and what I would sometimes do is, and I apologize for all that noise in the background of my parents.
That's fine.
But what I would do is I would go backstage and I'd meet some of the bands and hang out with them and make friends if I didn't know them, and see if I could get them to play the Cat House. And so I walked in there to see Nirvana, and Kurt Cobain was just passed out face down on the green room. So I never got to talk to him. So then I finally go to the set, not ever talking to Kurt Cobain. And I mean, you saw the show. I mean, if it looked like I was uncomfortable, but I wasn't like, you know, oh my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm so nervous. I was like, whatever. And then during the breaks, I felt like I was on heroin. I was just like, I was nodding off, just being part of that stupid interview.
Osmosis. Was he in the dress when he was passed out backstage? Did you know he was coming out in the dress? That is spectacular.
No, great.
And it wasn't probably until after the Headbangers Ball that I got the joke. Oh, it's the Headbangers Ball. You wore a ball gown. I never got it. I didn't get it because
I didn't get it until just now, to be honest with you.
Exactly. Great.
The other thing that's crazy is MTV never let you have a final episode, which is fucked up. But the thing that's bizarre to me, all TV now is pitching to the older generation. The only people that still turn on cable are people over 40. So they're rebooting every sitcom. They're rebooting. The fact that they haven't done this yet is bonkers to me. Because they will get my audience, our age, to watch the fucking show.
But you know what will happen when they do it? They'll do it, and it'll be total shit. And this is something I haven't said in any of my podcasts or interviews, and something that just bubbled up last night in me when I woke up in the morning and saw a meme that said, you know metal's dead when you see Slash and Wolfgang playing with Ryan Gosling. That's when you know metal's dead. And I lost my mind. I'm like, well, was it dead when Eddie Van Halen played with Michael Jackson?
Yeah, of course.
Was it not dead when Lemmy? I go, people have to make up their mind. Is their scene dead or are they exploited because they're so big? It's just like, I'm so sick to death of grumpy old fuckers complaining about everything. And here's the thing. And this is really important that I'm saying that I don't think anybody else is coming and saying. If you think that the 80s rock scene was nothing but a good time, then you weren't a part of the 80s right. rock scene.
It was a little
and
dark.
Every fucking show makes it look so damn goofy and nobody takes it seriously. And that's why if I do a show, it's going to be, it's not a music show. I meant a docuseries or something like mm-hmm. that. If I did that show, it's going to show what the scene was really like because everybody makes it look like bubblegum. Look, I read the book, Nothing But a Good Time. Think the book's great. I have it right there.
Fun book.
They interviewed me for the movie. But the truth is everybody's making everything so goofy, bubblegum, and they diminish a scene. And the way that we look at it now is stupid. Like there was a lot of struggling. There was a lot of camaraderie. There was a lot of rivalries. There was a lot of death. There was a lot of desperation, and that's what made the good bands in the 80s do well is they were hungry, and there was a lot of, you know, just disgusting stuff and a lot of magical stuff. You know, I was part of, I think, the greatest scene in rock and roll, and I'm kind of sick of everybody portraying it as being something stupid and goofy.